Hello, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. I am your host, Katerina Stoykova, and I have the pleasure of serving as the director of the Kentucky Book Festival, a program of Kentucky Humanities. The next installment of KBF will take place on November 2nd at Joseph Bett Booksellers from 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Today's episode features an author who will participate in the festival. This is fiction writer Wes Blake. Hi, Wes. How are you today?
Hi, Katerina. I'm doing well.
You are the author of Pineville Trace, which is a story of a man on the run, and much more, of course. Tell us more.
Sure. So this is a story about a former faith healer, a revival preacher named Frank Russett. And so by the time that this story begins, he finds himself in a minimum security prison for fraud in eastern Kentucky. And so he decides just to walk away from that. And he's befriended this cat that he names Buffalo, this stray cat that kind of befriends him, really, too. But so they take off. And so one thing that makes this kind of a different escape story, you know, if you escape from a maximum security prison and you're in for a long time, that's one thing. But when you escape, you know, you walk away essentially from a minimum security prison, it's more of an existential act. You kind of want to separate yourself from your former life. So that's the gist of it.
And there are many kinds of escapes and there are many kinds of prisons. It's a topic well worth exploring.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right. And this explores escape a lot on those other levels that you're talking about. You know, there's a lot of psychology involved with his escape from kind of the person he's had to become, you know, to make it in his former life. There's a lot of escape from that, and his past kind of haunts him. And so you're exactly right. The prison escape is maybe just the smallest part of it, I would say.
Well, you say it's the story about getting what you want and the story about not getting what you want. What about getting what you want just to find out that you're stuck with something you don't want?
I think there's something almost singularly American about that idea. But this character, Frank Russett, he's strived so hard to build this following as this faith healer and this revival preacher through the South. And there's this moment in his life where he strikes up this deal with this border antenna on the border between Mexico and the U.S. And so a lot of this really happened there. You know, this was a common occurrence. And so he becomes even larger, and he finds that when he does get what he wants, it just wasn't fulfilling in the way that he thought it would be. And it kind of the kind of work that he does, being someone that's supposed to heal people and is supposed to fulfill people, kind of adds another element of irony to that.
Please read us some.
Of course. I'm going to start with this chapter here called Pine Mountain Pass. And this is an early chapter. So this finds Frank. He's in the minimum security prison. And so this minimum security prison was based on an actual place called Bell County Forestry Camp. It's on Pine Mountain near Pineville, Kentucky. And so that was really a big inspiration for the book when I visited there. But anyways, here is a Pine Mountain Pass. He laid on his back on top of the thin prison mattress with his hands behind his head, looking up. His eyes trailed a dust mote floating in the blinding morning sunbeam that poured through the window. His eyes squinted against the bright, and he felt warmth on his eyelids and forehead. He imagined Pine Mountain Pass as it used to be, as the final difficult turn in a long journey. He imagined a Shawnee hunter passing through, going home, back north, and west, always west. He couldn't imagine going any direction except west. It would go against every legend and myth that breathed in this slab of time and land that he knew. At dusk, in the last moments of soft light, he'd look up at the pine-dappled ridge, holding on to the warm last light, and imagine animals and people passing through, along the path. His mind's eye would see Daniel Boone, the big turtle, walking slowly and surely along the ridge in the dusk. Other nights, it was a Shawnee woman, among a group of Shawnee, stepping lightly along the final pass of the Path of Warriors. But most of the time, he'd stand outside, behind his white cinder block walled prison dorm, feeling the dust cold enter his fingers and the back of his hands, sick with the pleasant scent of camel cigarette smoke, and see the ghost of a buffalo, stopping to eat acorns from the ground, moving among a group of buffalo down the path, looking for a good open place to bed down for the night. The ghost buffalo had almost reached the fertile valley. Like Moses, she could look out over her promised land. This was her path, across the mountains. The buffalo created this path, and for generations they walked their path. The trace left by their bodies was clear, wide. The Shawnee followed the buffalo's trace. They were wise and listened to the animals, and followed them. And Daniel Boone listened to the Shawnee. In the dark after dusk, Frank's cigarette ember burned red near the tan butt. He imagined one lone buffalo remaining, still walking the old path above the ridge, still following her ancestor's path. He felt something brush against his right calf. He looked down at the long-haired gray cat. She looked up at him and meowed. "Hello, buffalo," he said. He leaned over and stroked her soft fur under her ear and petted her along her back. She stretched her back up to meet his hand. "Are you hungry, sweetheart?" She meowed again. Even in the dark, he could see her green eyes looking up at him. He flicked his cigarette out onto the concrete, took a piece of tinfoil from his pocket, unwrapped it, revealing the ground hamburger, and set it down on the concrete slab. Buffalo ate the hamburger quickly, purring. He petted her side while she ate. Buffalo was used to his bleach-scented hands. When he first started the dishwashing job, she sniffed his hand tentatively the first two nights. But now she accepted it as his scent. The hamburger was gone, and Buffalo licked at the empty tin foil. "How goes your recon? Have you found an escape for us yet?" Frank said. The sound of Buffalo's tongue scraping against tin foil ceased. Crickets chirped. In the woods, an owl called out. Buffalo looked up at Frank and rubbed her side against his left calf. "You already know the way, don't you? Your ancestors knew it, didn't they?" Buffalo circled his leg and he petted her side. "I'll follow you," he said. Frank sat down on the concrete slab that jutted along the back wall of the prison dormitory. He leaned against the cinder block wall and felt the cold press into his back. Buffalo climbed on his lap and lay down. He felt the vibrations of her purring against his leg. He stroked Buffalo behind her ears and looked up at the black pine ridge that blocked out the stars.
Buffalo and Frank against the world.
That's right. That's exactly right.
This is such beautiful writing.
Well, thank you.
I have to ask, are you a poet?
I love poetry. I love poetry. I read it all the time and I admire poets. When I sit down to write, I've tried to sit down to write poetry. I find that I can express what I want to better when I'm kind of in mixed forms. So with this, I've talked about this a little bit before. This form, it's a novella in flash. So I envisioned each chapter as a standalone, brief flash story, meaning between 500 and 1,000 words. But there's something about that form that it's like a cousin of the narrative poem. And so writing in that form, that was my happy medium. It was kind of between poetry and prose, but I feel at home there. I loved writing in this kind of mixed form.
Well, we all end up writing but the way we can, and
yes,
whatever we feel comfortable with. I know other poets who write fiction or nonfiction or whatever, and what they end up doing is they write fragments, because it's much harder for a poet to sit down and, well, let me write War and Peace right here. That first of all, I wouldn't dare sit down. That wipes it out of existence right there. And then who has the time? We have cell phones to look at, other things to do.
I agree. And it's funny you say that, because when I set out to write this, this was the kind of book that I wanted to read. I love novellas.
Yes.
I really do. And
not too many people write them. That was my next question. What attracts you to novellas?
I've always loved that form. You know, even in high school, you know, everybody reads Mice and Men by Steinbeck. That's kind of the one that comes to mind. But, you know, Hemingway had a big comeback with, you know, The Old Man and the Sea after he said he was over and he come back. You know, that was a big critical comeback for him. But you know, recently I really got into the writer Richard Brautigan.
Okay.
And I feel like he's underappreciated. They kind of put him in the 60s, you know.
He's another poet for you, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And all he writes Flash, you know, he has that Revenge of the Lawn, but all his books are novella length. And I just love that. I just love that form. I came across, within the last couple of years, I read Jim Harrison's, they made the movie into it, but Legends of the Fall, it's a novella originally. And that's a striking novella as well. But I was just kind of reading all these novellas and I just love them. I feel you can get into them, you can have this emotional cathartic experience, and then you get out, it can get you into it more than a short story. Like you said, they're often lyrical. And like you said, another thing I think that is important in this world that we live in, you know, being able to read a flash or a fragment is probably more akin to our regular everyday experience as readers.
I would love to hear more about your process and editing and how much time did it take?
Sure. So the process of this, I got really inspired to write this story. I thought I was done writing about Frank Russett because in 2014 to 2017 or 18, you know, I kept tinkering with this novel called Antenna. And so I thought I was done with that character, and I was traveling for work in Pineville, Kentucky, and I just saw, you know, Pineville, like the town of Pineville. Have you been there? It was the first. It was one of the first times. Maybe I'd been there once many years ago. But I saw it, and it's kind of like on the mountain, and the houses kind of like go right up the mountain. It's a real striking place. I've never seen a town quite like it. And then Pine Mountain, it looks like the Pacific Northwest. There's all these pine trees. I mean, it's called Pine Mountain for a reason, you know. But that was kind of the inspiration for that, and that was February 2022. And so I got this idea in the original book, you know, Frank meets this cat and it's kind of a passing thing, you know, it's really not a major part of the story. And I kind of got this idea as I was driving through Pine Mountain and seeing Pineville, Kentucky, I got this idea for this there was more about Frank's story that I needed to explore. And so the image that I had was him and a cat walking away from the minimum security prison. And so, that was my inspiration, and I really wanted to write it to figure out, okay, well, what would happen? What, you know, where would they go? What would happen? How would that go? And that was very beginning of February 2022. And so I wrote the first draft. If memory serves, I think maybe through November-ish or something like that, I worked on the first draft. And then I set it aside for a while and worked on another book. I hadn't always done that, but I read the Stephen King book and he talked about that. And I thought, okay, that sounds good. Put it in a shelf for a while so you come back to it and it's new and you're not so attached to it. You know, you can kind of see it for what it is rather than what you intended it to be. You can see what's on the page. So actually, that was helpful. So I circled back to it, started in February 22, let's say around November 2022, first draft, set it aside. Came back to it in the spring of 2023 and started, you know, going through and polishing it and did several rounds of polishing it. And I would do this on my computer. I should say when I wrote the first draft, in this book in particular, I got into a routine of writing in the morning. So I'll try to write first thing. And a lot of this book sprung from intuition and subconscious. A lot of times I had some signposts of where I thought Frank and Buffalo might go. But a lot of it would lead from images that were in the previous chapter, and it would take me to the next one. And so a lot of the chapter titles are related to one another. But to circle back, when I was polishing it in 2023, worked on that for another maybe 5 months or so in 2023. And I remember this detail because I posted it on Instagram. When I finished it, I was almost done with it, and I had this, I was just excited about it. And I don't always do this. This was actually the fifth book that I've written. And I don't usually post when I finish a book. I just keep it to myself. But I was always excited about this book. It was a lot of fun to write, and maybe the form was a part of that and the discovery was a part of it. But that was when I was almost done with it. And so around the end of 2023, around November-ish was when I finished it, you know, and I sent it out to there was a I found this through Poets and Writers, pw.org. There was a novella prize, and it was called Etchings Press. They're a press out of the University of Indianapolis. And so they had a call for novellas, and they were looking at states, you know, kind of around Indiana. And so I submitted to it. I submitted it there. And so I'd kind of, for, you know how it goes, you send it off and you kind of go on with your life. And it was an election day, and I got off of work early to vote. And my wife and I live in Nonsuch, Kentucky. So I was coming back home, and I'd stopped in this little place to buy birdseed. And so I came out from getting the birdseed, and I checked my email just for the heck of it on my phone. And I saw that it had won that prize. And so that was kind of the journey. One thing about the revision process that I've done on the last few books that I find that's really helpful, after the first few rounds of polishing, I'll print it out and then have it on the page and go through and mark it that way. And I find that's helpful. I do at least a couple rounds that way.
What time do you get feedback from friends?
Well, my most trusted reader, the poet Tina Andre, she's been great, and she gives me a lot of feedback. So I don't send it out. I don't share it with anyone until I get it as perfect as I can get it. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have sent it to Tina did give me some feedback that she, you know, it was one that she seemed really excited about, and I can tell, like, I could tell it was one that she liked. And so that's helpful for me, just to know, you know, what's the general response, because you're so married to it when you're writing it, you don't really know. But I don't show anyone until it's as perfect as I can get it.
So how close of a relationship did you develop with the main character over the course of writing and editing? And what about your relationship with Buffalo also?
Yeah. I feel like Frank's a friend of mine. I really did become close with this character. I got the idea for Frank, and I remember it was a big moment when I thought of the idea for this character. I went to the Bluegrass Writers Studio at Eastern Kentucky University. It was 2014. I was teaching high school English, and I had studied creative writing at the University of Kentucky with Gurney Norman and James Baker Hall. And I had written, but kind of gotten out of the habit of writing regularly. And I was teaching high school English, and I really wanted to get more in the routine of writing regularly. So I signed up for the Bluegrass Writer Studio. And I remember when I first sent my submission in, my writing submission in, I was talking with the director at the time, and I was on the phone, and they have a summer session, and it's in Portugal, Lisbon, Portugal. And it's through Disquiet, this Disquiet literate program. And so I was wanting to obviously go there and start as soon as I could. And so I remember talking on the phone in my classroom. I taught at West Chestnut High School, and it was at the end of the day, and I was kind of cleaning up the room. And I was talking to Derek Nikitas, who was the director at the time. And I said, well, you know, is it too late to, can I get in and go to Portugal this time? And he said, yes, you could. And I said, well, who's going to be there? And he said, well, Dennis Johnson is the featured writer, and Dennis Johnson's one of my heroes. So it was just really charged. It was a lot of fun. It was really exciting. While I'm there, one of the speakers said this phrase that really stuck with me. They said, write about what obsesses you. And that really got under my skin. I kept thinking about that. And I just joined the program in the summer. I didn't know anybody. I was just over in Portugal walking around by myself. I really didn't know anybody in the program yet. I hadn't taken any classes. So I was walking around Lisbon really thinking about this idea, because I wanted to find my subject. I wanted to come out of the program with a novel. And I started thinking about, I have a friend, one of my really good friends growing up, his great uncle was this regionally famous revival preacher with connections to Kentucky. And I heard all these stories about him, like people that knew him they just came away with such a feeling of authenticity, and they felt seen by him. And you could tell that people just felt, because of their interactions with him, they just felt so positive about it. And also there were allegations of fraud. And so this a character like that, I really wanted to explore. And that was kind of the inspiration for Frank. I wanted to write about a character like this. Like, who is that person really? You know, there was another story that actually is related to Pineville Trace, that character would sometimes, you know, just take off by himself. And like there was kind of this debate, like, is he just going on a fishing trip? Is he just going on a fishing trip in the Gulf? Or is he just really kind of doing the holy man thing? everything about this character was a question mark, and I wanted to write about a character like that.
Say more about healing, fraud, and truth.
One thing about this character, Frank Russett, that interested me from the beginning, this faith healer, this idea of healing. I wonder what parts of it are, is there any truth and any purity in it, or is it all just for gain? And that was something that I really was wondering about, because I wonder where these people come from. Is there a point where there is some purity and their intention is to help people and to heal people? And do they have some intuitive ability to really get a sense of who people are and understand them and guide them? I wonder that. And with this character, one thing I wondered about Frank Russett the whole time was, did he start out with a pure intention and with some truth and wanting to help people and wanting to heal people? There's this chapter, Magic City, that kind of gets at that, where he's going back and remembering some of the purity of what he did. It kind of contrasts with another story in the original novel. There's a chapter called, it was actually published in Louisiana Literature Journal years ago, but it's called A Sort of Miracle. And it really gets at the part that of his work in healing that's put on and the part that's genuine.
That is so wonderfully complex. Please read us more.
Of course. So this chapter is called Magic City, and so the novella is set up and it's structured. There's three parts. This is in the first part. This is when his cat Buffalo are still walking away from the prison in Eastern Kentucky. And so Magic City, there's kind of a couple meanings there. So Pineville is right there in Cumberland Gap, and it's right by Middlesboro. And way back when the Cumberland Gap was a big when it was, you know, the big interstate of the time, Middlesboro was kind of an up and coming city. And so the name for Middlesboro was Magic City. And there were kind of this idea it might be almost like, I just imagine like it was almost kind of had a similar future as Las Vegas or something. It was this exciting place. And so this is titled Magic City. And at this point, Frank and Buffalo, they are hitchhiking, and they're on the run, and they're on the way to Canada. In the dawn, Frank had walked north along the edge of the interstate, carrying Buffalo. He'd hitched a ride with some fishermen headed for Canada in a black Dodge Ram. An old man was driving, and his son was sleeping in the camper top-covered truck bed. The old man sipped coffee from a steel thermos lid cup. The old man had not said anything beyond, "Where are you headed?" when Frank got in, and "Coffee?" shortly after. Frank drank coffee from a styrofoam cup. The sun had not yet appeared, but light was rising at their left. In a few hours, they would be on a long bridge, the line between Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. And then they would be on the borderline of two countries. Frank remembered the old magic. It was always at the edge of things. The edge between day and night, between sunset and dusk. He could see the last light stealing in along the edges of the old canvas tent. Magic seemed effortless, but it was not. It was always planned, honed, carefully. One emotion built on top of another. Energy built in such a way that it would transform into belief, into release, catharsis. To get there, Frank used all the tools. Nostalgia, grief, joy, excitement, peace, in the right order, in the right strength, at the right time. The old songs, the new songs, the Old Testament judgment and despair, the New Testament forgiveness and repair, the everyday stories of despair, death, loss, hope, love, healing, laughter. And the space between sunset and last light was the window the magic crawled through. He led them up to it, carefully. The more effortless it seemed, the more hard work lay hidden. He had learned the path so well, it became intuition. It became natural, instinct. If it was done right, they were ready to surrender. Surrender to belief. He created that desire in them, that ability. And in that space of change between day and night, he showed them healing, showed them a hint of it, just enough that they could believe and they could feel. After he led them up to the edge of day and night, distracted them enough that they forgot the wonder of it, he made them see the reality of healing. Then they believed. And that was the magic. Belief. Belief in healing. That anyone could care enough to see and understand what they needed. And then, by force of will, to heal. A shard of morning sunlight, reflected in the truck's rearview mirror, blinded Frank. For a moment, almost struck him back into the present. But he was too far lost in the past, too deeply buried. He imagined it was the glare of the spotlight illuminating him under the revival tent, casting his shadow into a distant place. He remembered how whole and warm he felt, under the bright light, moving without knowing, all instinct, his body loose and relaxed, a conduit, an instrument. He would feel the vibrations of his words ringing out in his throat, booming through the microphone he gripped in his hand. He would feel the emotions swelling through his chest from where he did not know. He would feel his damp shirt collar against his throat, feel the cool breeze move through the revival tent, piercing between his suit coat and sweat-dampened shirt, cooling his skin. He would feel his chest rising and falling. Then the spotlight would fan from him at the lip of the stage, under the revival tent, back to his brother, Henry, standing at the back of the stage with his Martin guitar, new silver strings shining in the light, strumming a minor chord. The first chord of a minor song, a song about grace. He imagined Henry must have felt he had a minor life. The spotlight moved from the onstage show of healing back onto the individual, onto the crowd. Their healing. The old farmer sitting on the metal folding chair, the young woman with dark hair leaning forward with hands clasped, praying with her eyes squeezed tightly shut, shifting from the stage show down into the reality of their own soul, their healing, their offering, their communion. At the end, everyone was left alone with their own soul, even Frank, even you. And the spotlight was blinding, burning hot in the humid southern nights. He sometimes wished it was the healing, it was the blinding brightness of a terrible angel wrenching him from this world. He imagined Henry, smiling in the spotlight, going into a major chord, imagining a major life, carrying the magic carefully, like a flame against a great wind.
It makes me think about the lengths we are willing to go to be important in somebody else's life, don't you think?
I do. That's interesting, because you've got the two brothers there, and the one brother's at the front of the stage and the other is in the back, and the minor chord and kind of that feeling of importance. And that's an interesting point, because I hadn't thought about that, you know. And there's that, I think that's something everybody wants. Everybody wants to feel important, you know. I think that's what is driving Frank Russett a lot. One big conflict in his life, and that kind of plays out in Pineville Trace, is he's always on the move. You know, he's always trying to build this life. And at the bottom of that is kind of a fear of you know, in the past I've kind of thought of it was a fear of losing everything. But I think that maybe even deeper, on a deeper level than that, it's a feeling of not being important, not mattering. Maybe that's the real fear
of insignificance.
Yes.
That is one of the scariest things.
I'm glad you said that, because I hadn't thought of that, but I completely agree.
And it's right here. Yeah, it's right here. And the other thing is healing by belief rather than healing by faith.
Yes. Yes, you're exactly right. And it's more tangible, isn't it? Healing through belief is kind of more...
Well, then
tangible.
It's where it comes from. It comes from me versus it comes from higher power.
Right.
Yeah, who gets the credit for that?
Right. That's a good point. That's a really good point.
I think that the writing is truly brilliant, Wes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
What has the reception been so far?
It's been nice. I was so excited. I sent the work out to a few people to blurb, and I sent it to Lee Martin, the writer of The Bright Forever, the Pulitzer Prize finalist, And I was so appreciative of his words. He said his words were, Westblake renders the tale with great empathy and in language that's so lyrical it practically lifts from the page. And coming from Lee Martin, someone who's writing, I appreciate so much. That meant a lot. There was a review in Smokelong Quarterly, and I was really appreciative of the kind words that they had to say about the book. Maybe one of the most complimentary things that I heard. There was a reader that read the ARC, you know, the advanced reader copy, and I'm loosely quoting here, but her name is Brooke, and she said that. She said she rarely finds a book. Rarely is it that a book comes out of the blue and made her feel so deeply connected in this feeling of catharsis, that she she was thinking about the story days after she read it, and there was a lot to contemplate about Frank.
You know, that is really very high compliment to have your work be memorable. That means it really connects with the reader. That's great.
That's what I wanted. The books that I really love, like Ironweed by William Kennedy and you know, Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood, and we were talking about even the short story A Hunger Artist by Franz Kafka, Fat City by Leonard Gardner would be another one. They haunted me, and I was affected, and that's really more than anything else. I want my work to have an effect on people and to impact people, and so that was one of the greatest compliments that I could get, because that's what I want, and those are the books that I love do that. So I was really happy to hear that.
Well, Pineville Trace is not the first book that you wrote, but it's the first one that you published.
Yes,
speak about that.
It's actually the fifth book that I've written. The first book was Antenna, like we were talking about, the same character, Frank Russett. And so this is his later years, and Antenna is really his beginning when he starts out and is starting to make it in the world and make his way as a faith healer. And so that book, I've gotten some agents that have been interested in it, and I've gotten, it was a semi-finalist in the UNO Lab Prize, the University of New Orleans Prize. And I cannot speak of it yet, but it was a finalist in another one, but I can't talk about it yet. It's top secret until it's a release. But, you know, it's really nice to find a home for Frank. So I've been, you know, enjoying writing about him for a long time. And I've found, you know, there's stories and excerpts from that have been published in other places. But to get the book out to readers is really nice. It was... After, you know, from 2014, so I've been very dedicated, you know, in my writing practice since 2014. And so it's been fun to have the book out and to connect with readers and kind of hear what, you know, if how the book impacts people. It's just, it's fun. It's like, it's the difference between playing guitar in your room by yourself and like getting in front of people and playing for people. It's a lot of fun.
So you live in Nonsuch, Kentucky. Please describe this place to us.
Sure. So
sounds non-descriptive to me.
right. It's what is such a strange name, Nonsuch. So it's in southern Woodford County. It's very rural. We're about a mile and a half from the Kentucky River. We live on a little bit of property there. My wife has a couple horses. And so our main project there in Nonsuch has been planting trees. That's kind of been our life. We've planted over 116 trees between, you know, when we moved in and now. And so it's nice. It's about, you know, Nonsuch is about 30 minutes from Lexington, you know, and it's about 30 minutes from Nicholsville and Versailles. So it's kind of equidistant, but it's also far enough away from things. It's so nice not to have the light pollution. When I remind myself to go out and look up at the sky at night, it's so cool. I love that. You know, you get the... you know, you've got the commute to places, but it's just really nice to be out there and have some distance and you know, have a break from the light pollution and things like that.
Do you own land there?
It's just a little bit. We're on 4 acres out there, but we're surrounded by, there's some big farms around us. There's some 30 and 40 and 50 acre spots around us that
I'm asking because my question is, where do you plant those trees?
We're running out of space. Running out of space at this point. You're exactly right. When we first went out there, my first comment, because when we went out there to look at the house, and this is back in 2013, but when we looked at it, you know, I said, there's no trees. And there really were not. There were not any trees at all. And we had this really great, probably 100-year-old wild black cherry tree. And we lost it. It got sick and we lost it. And so when we lost that tree, we kind of doubled down on planting more trees. But we've just about run out of space at this point.
Most people do it exactly the opposite. They buy a wooded lot and cut down all the trees to have space for something else. You and your wife are doing the exact opposite.
You're exactly right. Matter of fact, my grandma...
Why didn't you buy a wooded lot to start with?
We should have. That's what we should have done. Yeah.
Not too late.
That's right. You're right. We're doing the opposite. By the time I'm dead, we're going to have a good bit of trees, you know, for someone else. But no, you're right, though. I remember my grandmother's house in Mount Sterling. She had these really great pin oak trees and just loved them. And, you know, she planted them. They were huge. And then, like you said, the person that bought the house took them out. You know, that's usually what people do. We just didn't have enough sense to do it the smart way. We made it hard on ourselves.
I don't know of a better service to the next generations than planting trees. I mean, to quote W.S. Merwin, on the last day of the earth, I will plant a tree.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. I like that a lot.
You're a poet. I thought that you're a poet since the very first paragraph of your book. The sentence structure, the rhythm, the word choice, the attention to detail, the beauty of the language, and the emotion in every sentence. You're a poet. I want to read your poems.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Besides your prose.
Right. Well, thank you.
And you mentioned EKU MFA. It's all over your resume and CV. Speak about that influence.
Sure. So I had a great experience with the Eastern Kentucky University. There, they have a low residency MFA program. It's called the Bluegrass Writers Studio. And so I had a great experience there. This character came out of that program. That was my thesis was the novella there. Antenna is the name of that work, but it was a great experience. I made friends there that I'm still friends with. My thesis director, Julie Hensley, who has actually a new book coming out really soon called Five Oaks that I'm really excited about. She was with me at the launch in Lexington, and you know, we did the In Conversation With event. But they've been so supportive. They've recommended ways to get my work out and kind of guided me along the process. And so they have open mics that I still go to and stay in touch with. And they were nice enough to ask me to come read at their summer conference. They have a summer conference at EKU in Richmond every summer. But it's been great. It's a great community, and they've done really nice things. And they have that cool connection with Disquiet. So it's low residency, but you get these times where you can either choose to go to Lisbon, Portugal, or to do a writing, you know, retreat there, essentially, in a conference, or you can go to Richmond. So it's really nice. You get these periods of the low residency versus, I don't know, almost the high residency, you know.
You're a recipient of the annual RUDI Achievement Award in recognition of exemplary performance and work ethic. You're also recipient of Golden Nugget Award for going the extra mile, and top student in German literature and sales rep of the week. So you're someone who does not shy away from hard work. How did you learn that in this world of instant this and instant that? It's an increasingly rare skill, don't you think?
Yes, I do. And that's interesting you point that out. That was from, so the Golden Nugget Award, that was from my work at the Herald Leader. My first job out of college, I wrote obituaries. That's where I met my wife. She wrote obituaries as well. And so that the RUDI Award, that was when I worked in sales. I sold Yellow Pages ads. You know, this is my second job right out of college. And I remember when I got that RUDI Award, I almost felt like that was an insult. It's like, wait a minute, you know, the movie RUDI, where you've got the, you know, he's like a little guy and he makes it on the team finally. And so I kind of felt, wait a minute, does that mean I don't have any talent? What does that mean? But the more I thought about that over the years. It's funny that you bring that up, because I really feel more and more that that's a compliment, because I think that that ability to be persistent and to keep working at things, it is more important than talent.
I don't know if I would agree with that, but it is just as important.
Just as important.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. You know, as far as where did that come from, I don't know. Maybe it was my mom and dad are really hardworking. My parents are grew up in Mount Sterling, Kentucky, and they're both really hardworking. I remember when I was young and we lived in Moorhead, Kentucky, and my dad worked at Kentucky Utilities. I remember him studying all the time, you know, to get his master's degree. And, you know, my mom was always working so hard on everything to take care of us and just to take care of her parents. And so I don't know. My brother and sister are both that way as well. They're both really hardworking. I don't know exactly where that came from. I can only guess that maybe our mom and dad rubbed off on us. We were kind of lucky that way.
I have to tell you that reading your resume and CV here, I would hire you in a heartbeat.
I appreciate that. Yeah. It was nice to hear that. I remember even like working in sales and they gave me that award. It was just really nice to hear that, because I've kind of found out, and this kind of connected into writing, this kind of relates to your question earlier, you know, about getting the work out. I had to do little things to keep myself, you know, kind of focused on writing. So I would I would go to AWP, and part of it was to kind of connect and talk with people, and part of it was just to make myself continue to keep working, because I would, if I went to AWP or the Books in Progress conference at Carnegie, I'd highly recommend that to anybody who's listening that, you know, that is interested in writing or wants to send their work out or find a home from it. That's been great, but I would sign up for things like that because it would kind of force me to keep working, you know, and stay in the routine.
Speaking of working, what are you working on now?
I'm getting in the home stretch of the first draft of a new book. And so it's tentatively titled To Bury. And it's the connections between this book are kind of interesting when I think about it, because I've just started to think about it lately as I'm almost done with it. But it's the main character is this girl named Jamie, and she kind of had this hard scrabble childhood. She grew up in a neglected home, and her way out, she wants to become a psychic or a medium, and she's trying to develop her intuition and her psychic ability, and that's kind of her way out. And so anyways, that's the new book that I'm working on. And it's been a lot of fun to write. It's kind of funny that some of the ways that I started writing about this, writing in Pineville Trace, are staying with me. I find myself writing short chapters, and part of it is because I love reading short chapters. When I read a book, I just love those short chapters. There's this book that was the form was such an influence on Pineville Trace is We the Animals by Justin Torres, and it's a novella in Flash. And he, actually, Justin Torres' newest book, Blackout, it won the National Book Award. And in Blackouts, he keeps those short chapters. And it was really nice to see that, because my mind, I'm there. I try to kind of connect with what I like as a reader, and I want to write the kind of things that I want to read. So that's the latest one. It's getting really close to the end of the first draft. It's been interesting. I've had to do a lot of research on that, and so went and saw a medium, and that was an interesting story.
Here is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing, and that is, what is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from your class or your workshop, what is it?
So these days, most of the writing that I teach is composition. I have taught, you know, when I taught high school English for years, I taught more creative writing. But what's the one thing that I want to teach? I'll tell you one of the funnest classes I ever taught was a Kentucky literature class. And I taught this at West Jasmine High School. And it wound up being a small group of students that signed up for it. But we had so much fun. And we did a lot of creative writing in there. But I think the important thing is that give people a chance to, the most important thing is to give people opportunity to tell their own stories. everybody wants to tell their story. And I think it kind of goes back to your idea about people fear being insignificant and people want to feel important. And I think telling your story is a way for people to feel important. And also, people tell stories. That's how people create their identity. They tell stories. Families and friends have these stories that we always repeat to define. They're not just entertainment. That's how they define who they are. And so giving that gift to people is so important. You know, my grandfather, before he died, he was really wanting to write his stories down. And he was from Menifee in Morgan County, and he had all these great stories. He was a jazz piano player, and his dad was the judge there. And so I think every person wants to tell their story. And so if you're teaching creative writing, you're giving people I feel like one of the most important gifts that you can give someone, you're giving them a chance to tell their story, and even to tell their story for their ancestors that didn't have a chance to tell their story. And I think that's so important.
Thank you, Wes, for coming to Accents, and I'll see you at the festival.
Yeah, really looking forward to it. And thank you for having me, Katarina. I appreciate it.